Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome back Tony Connolly, the man behind Rock Guitar Daily Blog. We're going to be speaking with Tony about the state of the guitar and music instrument industry, along with talking with him about his book that he's finishing up on Paul McCartney's musicianship. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Flotadizzo Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great show, and we're going to be talking about a lot of interesting things tonight. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I am doing good. Before I even talk about some of the videos I released, I do want to say that a big congrats out to Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble for finally getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They should have been there years ago.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no. And also, I also have been seeing things posted, too, that Ringo finally got in there, which is kind of cool.
So. I'm going to be completely honest. I don't understand that.
What do you mean?
I understand him as a Beatles person, but not as an individual artist. But that's my personal opinion. I'll probably get a lot of hate mail for that, but,
yeah, but
I don't understand it.
Even as a Beatle, he influenced drumming forever. That's true. You're
but
not a drummer.
But he's in there as the Beatles. So why is he in there individually?
Anyways. Well, McCartney is too. But he did influence.
But McCartney did things that were worth something.
He did change. He did. Oh, you're going to get hate mail now.
I'm fine. Watch him sing and dance. That's just ridiculous to watch him sing and dance.
But he changed drumming. He and Jeff Emmerich changed. We'll talk about a little bit. We're going to be talking to Tony about Paul McCartney, and we'll definitely get into Beatles, the innovations that the Beatles did. And
I think all the Beatles were great. Ringo's just on the lower level of all four. He's a drummer anyhow, so
hey, watch it, buddy. I resent that remark. Okay, anyway, all right, we're gonna go ahead and take a break because we got a lot to cover, and it's gonna be a harebrained show because I'm gonna try to cover all the stuff that we have scheduled to talk with Tony because Tony's got a lot of information for us. So anyway, we'll be right back, and we'll be on with Tony Connolly.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at Sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at Sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red apply now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying rock on with the Flow.
Hey, this is Tracy Guns, and right now you are listening to the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts Show with Scott and Jeff and Andy and Tracy, and we're all here partying and going nuts. Anyways, this is the only guitar show I know of that you get to listen to guitar players and manufacturers talk about the cool stuff, and you can call in and talk to them, and you're going to have a good time.
how to play something with some kick-ass guitar in there for you, Tony. Anyway, I want to welcome Tony Connolly to the show. We've had him on before, and he does this blog that's pretty well internationally known, rockguitardailyblogspot.com. And he's also an editor at metaltalk.net. But he's done a lot of different articles, and if you follow him, and I recommend that you do on Facebook and Twitter and stuff, he covers it, and he really talks the talk about bands and guitar players. Tony, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Jeff, thanks so much. It's always two-sided coin. It's a great pleasure to be asked, and it's always a lot of fun, you know? So it's like, it's just... I love getting your call, and I'm always happy to participate, and it's good to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. All right, let's just dig right into it, because I want to cover a lot of stuff. Let's talk about guitar 2015, the state of the guitar. What is your opinion right now? Do you think that the industry's healthy? Do you think it's, you know, are we in a recession musically? You know, I know that everybody's screaming about, you know, the record companies have kind of collapsed and stuff. I have noticed we had talked about this earlier. I had noticed that there are a lot more people playing live because that's where their livelihood's coming from now. Instead of the CDs, it's more coming from the playing live. But what do you think? I mean, I see one of the things I noticed at NAMM is there were millions of guitars there. I mean, all sorts of stuff and pedals. And what's your take?
My take on it is it depends on who you talk to. I talk to a lot of people who are making a living, they're getting by, they're paying their mortgages. They might not be buying private jets, but they're still in the game. You know, I know guys who are going into the amp and guitar manufacturing fields and opening up new shops. And on the flip side of the coin, I know it's a very difficult economy for anyone in the middle class, and especially if you're in the arts. We've been riddled from, you know, the actual players down to the ancillary members of the artistic community, and everybody's felt the economic changes, but I think there's a lot of great stuff going on as well.
Well, one of the things I'm going to ask you and see what you think about is I think that the market's changed a little bit. In 20 years ago or so, or even a little longer, the primary buyers of musical instruments were musicians. But I think now you have another market too, and you can see what I was seeing at the show, especially, is all these artist models, and they're very expensive. And I think there's a market for collectors. I think that's the new market. There's other people buying guitars that are not necessarily players or you know gigging players. But the thing is, because every guitar player I know, I've had guys in here that are session players and stuff. And their Les Pauls and their Strats, they bought used maybe years ago. You know, they're not spending $8,000 to $10,000 on a guitar, and most musicians I know can't afford to spend $8,000 or $10,000. So, but there is a market. I've seen a lot of upscale people that have made their money. Now they want to play a little bit and they want to collect. And you know, there's all these great models that are replicas of their favorite guitar players. I mean, what do you think about that? Because I think that changed the market.
You may have just kind of did the microcosm perfect explanation for what's happened in the market, because you're exactly right. The high end is doing wonderfully. The custom shops are doing great. You're seeing $1 million auctions and guitars that shouldn't be going for $1 million going for more money than they should. But on the other hand, you're right. At the player grade, there's been a tremendous deterioration on the amount of gigging musicians. Mm-hmm. And so there's less kids coming up playing guitar because there's less awareness. But, you know, it's just a shift. I don't think you're ever going to have a situation where you have a golden age like we had in the 80s, a remarkable golden age in the guitar, and everything was beautiful. But that you just can't maintain that altitude forever. You got to come down and breathe sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned something when we put together some notes about what to talk about, and it cracked me up what you mentioned. But you were talking about, you know, that you think that some of the a couple of years back there was a lot of overproduction of too many. They were making way too many instruments than the market could bear. And I have to admit, when I'd go on an online site, like, you know, well, even, you know, there's any of the major ones, our sponsor, Sweetwater, there's there's a bunch of Les Paul models. There's all these different models, and there's all these different Strat models, all made by Fender. I'm not quite sure exactly what the differences are from each of them. I mean, some of them it's obvious, but I don't, you know, is that because, you know, besides the artist models and stuff like that. Why do you think that? I mean, what do you think that's part of that over manufacturing?
You can almost completely tie that to the difficulties that have come to pass at Guitar Center, because they are certainly, when they went public and they started building stores at a really accelerated rate, and they're filling these stores with guitars, and I know that, you know, they built everywhere they could. It got into the manipulation of monies, I think, and you get into a different economy. You're not running them like music stores. You're just running them as big box retail shops. And it hasn't really worked with music instrument retail, because one thing I think is the quality of salesmen goes down as the wages in the industry go down, and they've went down tremendously. And you have this proliferation of instruments. You know, there's a lot of great Fender Stratocasters. I can come up with a lot of great combinations that I would think would be cool. I don't know that I could come up with 77 different models of Stratocaster.
Right. I mean, I understand some have exotic woods, and that makes sense. And that's part, but that's more like a custom type of thing. But some of these Les Pauls, they're different colors and stuff, but I don't think that's why they're different models, or even some of the Strats. It's hard to tell. Maybe there's a different pickup or something like that, or is it the woods? They don't always mention what woods they're using in the bodies all the time. That's one of the things I've noticed. But
that may be true with Fender, but not with Gibson.
No, Gibson
always tells.
Yeah, well, and some of them are chambered, some of them are solid, you know. That's true. No, that is true, that they are, you know, that it's interesting, though, the fact that there's just so many out there. It's quite confusing in the price range. I mean, what's the real difference between a $2,000 Les Paul and a $4,000 Les Paul? And I'm not talking about the custom ones. What really is the difference? Is it just they're picking the wood a little pickier? The grains looks nicer to them? Ultimately, well, does it sound any different?
Usually the biggest price difference is the top, the maple top.
Yeah.
Look at their standards. Their standards range from $3,000 all the way to $5,000. And all it is that changes is the top.
It's just the top.
You know, the other side of this coin is the fact that there are more good professional level, reasonably priced guitars than there have ever been in history. There, you know, you for $500 you can buy a perfectly good gigging guitar. And there was a time when you couldn't do that. So you know, it's again, it's just a matter of how you want to look at this and how you want to define it. There's a lot of different stuff going on, a lot of different directions, and that's one of the reasons people have such a hard grasp of, is it good, is it bad? Well, yeah, it's both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately, as a player, again, if you're a collector or a casual hobbyist, that's one thing. But as a player, if it sounds good, I don't care if it's $20. You know what I mean? If it plays good. You know, some of those early guitars that a lot of these guys are use, these vintage guitars, some of the earlier Dan Electros and stuff, they weren't really high quality guitars. There was a slab of wood with, you know, like a fairly decent neck, but they sounded great. And it was just, you had the magic to it, you know? But Tony, I want to ask you another thing. We've talked a little bit about it on some of the other shows. Is this new thing that Fender had started, and I'm seeing it with other manufacturers, where they decided to go direct and sell direct. What do you think that's going to? Do you think that's going to be a negative or positive impact on the industry? And I know that there are other smaller companies now that are not hassling the brick and mortar stores. They're basically just selling direct now. What do you think about that?
Again, I hate to keep going back to this, but it's a tough call because, you know, it's going to happen. You know, I thought years ago that Fender would be the next Harley Davidson in terms of American branding. And I don't know that at the end of the day, that's necessarily a bad thing. I would love to go into a fantastic Fender store. I think that would be, you know, quite an experience. But it, what comes down to is, how do they make the change without offending their current dealers, the guys who have been making a living and taking care of Fender for the last 50 years? You know, are they going to figure out a way to segue into this without hurting them? Or are they going to run over them like a freight train? We don't know, and everybody's kind of waiting to see. And, the way American business has been going for the last 20 years, it's kind of a scary outlook. They might just do what they need to do, especially if, God forbid, anything would ever happen with the Guitar Center debt situation, because, if GC goes under, then who knows what's going on in our industry? It makes it a very hard to.
Yeah, they definitely have a big impact. But let me ask you a personal question. Mm-hmm. When you buy a guitar, do you go and play it, or would you buy it online and just mail order?
Well, I'll tell you what I told everybody. I sold guitars for 20 years, and I've got many phone calls from many guys who said, I'm looking at this Taylor guitar. I'm going to buy it for X amount of dollars. What do you have one? I say, yeah, and mine's, it's $300 more. And the guy's like, well, but I can get a mail order for $300 less. And I said, yeah, but I got three of them you can play. Let me ask you something. How did you come along your wife? I hope you didn't order her through the mail, because that's not how you get the quality. I mean, on a keyboard, I understand. On an amplifier, maybe. On a guitar, I got to play it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that for me, that's where you discover those little gems, especially when you're in the mid-range and stuff. I mean, it's true. At the NAMM show, for example, with Taylor, I played several different of their 800 series and their 600 series, and they were consistent. And same thing with Martin. A lot of the Martins are very consistent. Some of the other guitars, there's a big difference. Now, Scott, I'm sorry I interrupted you. Did you want to ask something?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask him. So if Guitar Center does go under, I mean, what's your feeling on that, Tony? Do you think it'll be ripe for small businesses to come back in the music industry?
Well, there would certainly be an instant need. So, yeah, I think that would happen. But the real problem there is what happens to the manufacturers if suddenly they stop getting paid everything the Guitar Center owes them. That might mean that they don't have payroll next week. They might not be able to buy wood for the next year. It becomes a very tenuous situation for a manufacturer. If somebody suddenly quits sending you this monthly stipend, then it gets very dodgy on what happens to everybody, I think.
Yeah. No, that's true. And the other thing is it has changed. I mean, Guitar Center, they have some selection now. I mean, you can go and play. There's some good brands that they don't carry anymore. But they're I think that one of the things for the stores is A, you can go play it and play different ones and compare. And B is the advice is to have somebody count, especially when I was a kid, I went to my local store and those guys advised me, like, try this guitar. That's where I learned some stuff, like, this pickup might be better. You might want to try this. You might want to do that. I think there's a need for that. That doesn't really happen online. Now, Sweetwater's pretty close because you can call them and they cover.
I would say Sweetwater actually does exactly that. I mean, I can tell you from my own personal experience.
Yeah, no, that
I mean,
too.
I bought a Les Paul from them, and I was worried about the neck size. I don't really like a big, fat 50s neck, but I was buying a guitar that had that, or claimed to have it, and I had the rep pull this thing right off the shelf and tell me what his opinion was. So,
yeah.
That's the kind of stuff you would get from them, which is a little bit different than, you would get from other sides. So they can also provide you their opinions on whether you should buy a particular piece of equipment, whether it's guitar or, recording wise.
Yeah, I have a perspective on that, and you're absolutely right. I was the first guy in the Guitar Center organization to ever have the title at store level of sales manager. It was my job to create sales for Guitar Center. And I trained countless managers, countless salesmen. We trained a lot of people. We trained them very well. So I can say I've been to Sweetwater. I've visited. I've been a customer. They are the best in the world at what they do. They do the amount of business because they do it better than anyone else in the game right now. They're just winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean,
go ahead.
No, but the only limitation I see even with a Sweetwater, unless you can go to Sweetwater because they do have their own showroom, is for me is to play a guitar. That's a tough one. That's a personal thing, but I mean, you really gotta play. And I'm not talking about the real, real high end ones. I'm talking about those mid range and lower priced ones because there's a lot of variation. They're not made like, you know, the quality control, the strictness. I mean, obviously, there's more labor involved on the bigger guitars. That'll always, I think, and I'm not saying that, and that's not a slight against, because I think what Sweetwater does is just killer. I mean, you can call them up anytime, and they will help you figure out what you need, and that's very cool. But I think in terms of it's nice to be able to go to a place and try them. That's where I learned about certain guitars, is, you know, somebody was carrying this guitar, and I never heard this brand before, and like, hey, that's pretty cool, you know.
Well, I don't think you're going to get that kind of knowledge unless you're in a place like LA or Nashville or New York. I mean, I just don't think
that's true.
I don't think the Guitar Center in Kansas City, Missouri, is going to provide you that kind of advice. I think you have to go to a store like a Norm's or a Gruen's or, you know, Chicago Music Exchange. Those kind of places where they actually have people that, you know yeah. their stuff.
But like friends of mine that went with, you know, in the earlier days that went to NAMM. And younger guys, younger players and stuff. The first thing when they were like playing the guitars, like especially like acoustic guitars, I would take them over to the Martin booth, and I'd make them play the D45. And they're like, "Well, I can't afford this." I said, "That's not the point. The point is now go find a guitar that sounds as close as you can get to that type of quality of sound, how it rings, it sustains. So you got a reference, and that's one of the things." When you play, and Guitar Center had like their real high end room, you really do need. You know, I've brought people over there, and it's like, play this guitar that's $10,000, because there's a reason why it is $10,000, and it plays this way. No, listen to the tone, listen to the overtones, the sustain. Now go play the other guitars, and they would spend a few hours in there, and they'd find something pretty decent at a reasonable price. I mean, you need that. You know, you need to be able to get that kind of reference, you know what I mean? I mean, what do you think, Tony?
Absolutely. I, you know, again, I come from so much experience in that direction, and I've had bad experiences with Guitar Centers in smaller markets. I've actually, you know, I was a customer at the Dayton, Ohio store, and you know, the service and the quality of knowledge I got from the guys that worked there wasn't very good. But at the same time, I'm sure they have lots of great employees at different stores in every city in the country. It's tough to tell, but there's always good guys in music stores work, and it's one thing you'll find. But Scott's certainly right. In the bigger markets, you're going to have a much more sophisticated sales force, much more knowledgeable, and you're probably going to have a better experience as a shopper. And yeah. I think that's one of the reasons Sweetwater, based in, you know, little Fort Wayne, Indiana, understands that, and they take really great care of the smaller markets, and, you know, they do a tremendous job there.
Yeah. No, I recommend to our audience too, if you're in Fort Wayne, go to their place, Sweetwater's place. They got a great showroom there, and they got everything. You can try everything. There's a lot of
coming up in June.
Yeah, that's right. They have that,
and I'll be going.
So Scott will be there, and we'll have video of that. Okay, well, listen, I want to get to part two of our discussion, and that is this book that you're writing about McCartney. Give us a little background on how you got into this and why you're doing this book.
Well, the first thing I would start off with saying is, you know, you'd think the last thing in the world that we'd need at this time in 2015 is another book on Paul McCartney. You know, there's been literally over 100 of them. There have been some really great ones, but I think I've tapped into something in the book that I'm doing, because I think, as far as I can tell, I may be the first guy that's come down the road and decided to strictly write on Paul as a musician and on his music, and not so much get into personality things, not get into sociological things, strictly dealing with the musicianship, strictly dealing with the music, and it's turning into a wonderful project.
Oh, that's great. That's a thing that gets kind of pushed aside sometimes. I mean, we all know him as a great songwriter, the Beatles. The newer generation knows him for Wings. But yeah, as a musician, he's a multi-instrumentalist. And there was a couple of things that we had talked about that I want to bring up. One of them is the bass overdub. That was unusual because usually, like even in the 60s, the Wrecking Crew and stuff, the bass was done on the bass. The stereo. They were ping ponging at that time. They didn't have a lot of tracks, so they would do the whole rhythm section, including bass or several basses. And then layer everything else if there were leads or whatever after the fact. The Beatles didn't do that. They did the drums and the guitars, and they did the bass as a separate overdub in one of the ping pongs. And from what I understand, reading from Jeff Emerick and stuff, they did that to make it punchier. But you were saying also, too, that he wanted to perfect the bass line. He was very careful. So a lot of that was I don't know anybody else that overdubbed a bass. Unless you do, but I mean, that seems like he was one of the first to do that, right?
I don't know if he was the absolute first, but he was certainly the first big proponent of it. And yeah, you're absolutely right. He is the first guy who is going in late at night after everybody else was gone, hooking up with an engineer and just working on his bass lines, tracking them, overdubbing them a piece at a time. How does it fit with what I'm singing? A really structured, really analytical, and really well played, bass, and it showed up on the records. And all of a sudden,
Oops, it's freezing. Hold on, Tony. let me try to get him back. Hold on a second. I'm gonna disconnect him and bring him back. Let's see if I can get him in.
I have a very good question for him when he gets back. Well, okay. I have to ask him why he didn't write a book on Ringo's musicianship.
Well, he might be writing a book on it later, but he's a guitar player. He's not a drummer, so.
I'm just being an ass.
He did influence. That whole dead drum sound came from Ringo, that real type of doom, doom, doom type of sound. So I, in his defense, I have to bring that up. Okay, I'm trying to get Tony back on.
Do you have a phone number for him? If
I can, yeah, but I think he'll come back on Skype. I think it's Tony? Tony? Hold on 1 second. Sorry about that. The wonders of the internet. Let me try again. Hold on 1 second. Disconnect it and add him again. I don't want to cut you off. That's what I'm trying to avoid. So hold on a second here. Let's see what happened. All right, let me try to get him on the phone. Hang on 1 second. I'm trying to. Okay, hold on. I'm going to go ahead and run the commercial real quick and try to get him on the phone line. We'll be right back.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red apply now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying rock on with the Flow.
Hey, this is Brent Mason with Jeff and Scott, Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, and enjoyed being on the show, and hopefully we'll get together again, and I'm going to go to bed. It's late. Thanks, guys.
Okay, where Tony, you back there?
I believe I am.
I just saw you talking, and it just like froze, and I'm like, uh-oh. So anyway, getting back to McCartney. Now, Scott, do you want to ask your sarcastic question or what?
It's a legitimate question.
All right, go ahead.
I mean, given that the man just got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how come he's not writing a book about Ringo's musicianship?
Because there's not enough for a book.
Exactly.
Hey.
I mean, and I'm not denigrating Ringo. I think he's one of the best drummers in history, one of the most incredibly creative drummers, one of the most musical drummers. Didn't do a lot musically after the Beatles. I don't.
Why is he in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Scott.
Well, because he's Ringo Starr and he wants to be.
But you have to admit the impact.
I've heard it's a pay-to-play kind of
thing. The impact of his drumming on drums, that dead sound that he developed using the double skins and that technique of the way he played, that influenced every drummer, I think, after from the 60s. A lot of the heavier rock drummers, a lot of the studio drummers, you know, there was only one guy that was doing something similar to him, and that was probably Al Blaine. But, I mean, the other guys were doing all of, you know, that changed the sound of drums. You have to agree. I mean,
But that's part of the Beatles.
It's still a drummer.
I think Ringo was a wonderfully unique drummer. If you listen to his fills, he doesn't duplicate himself because he doesn't know what he's going to do. There's a certain innate genius there that was perfect for that band.
Yeah.
And he influenced every drummer that came after him. I mean, you know, is he a Hall of Fame guy based on his solo career? Probably not, but I'd let the guy into anything just because he's Ringo Starr.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the point is he influenced rock music as an individual, as the Beatles, both.
I'm just playing devil's advocate. I mean, my favorite drummer worships the guy. So, I mean, I think he must be good because of that. But I'm not a big drummer guy.
All right. Well, we
digress. Mike Portnoy. That's the man right there.
We digressed. Let's go back a little bit back to McCartney, though. Now, one of the things I thought was interesting is that he played lead guitar in a lot of the classic Beatles songs. Can you tell us a little bit of what you found out, which ones he did? Because the album's never credited who played what all the time. I always assumed a lot of it was George.
Right off the top of my head, I have a few favorites. The lead on Ticket to Ride, and he played guitar on Ticket to Ride all the way through it. He played, and it's funny, one of the only times you'll hear Paul improvising as a musician is when he's playing lead guitar, and that was never more evident than on a song that George wrote, Taxman. And Paul does an incredible Yardbirds-y kind of Jeff Beck-ish Eastern riff as he's sliding down the neck. And it's the perfect lead because it even pays homage to George's love for all things Indian a bit in the solo.
And never knew that he did that. I always thought that was George.
And he threw it down just because George was having trouble coming up with something that he liked for his own song. Mm-hmm. And Paul says, give me a whack at it. And actually, on Taxman, what they do is he plays the solo, and then they just tack it onto the end of the song. And
yeah.
So the same solo plays twice, but it's brilliant. It's Jeff Beckish. It's skittering down the fretboard madness, and it's just so funny that the only time Paul seems to improvise, for the most part, is when he's playing lead guitar. And then there's other times. There's a great guitar duel between him and George on And Your Bird Can Sing, where they play harmonies together. And that influenced guys like Andy Powell from Wishbone Ash. We've talked about it. I know it certainly influenced Scott Gorham. We've talked about it. That was one of the first songs that had rock and roll harmony guitars on it, and it's McCartney doing it. And, of course, you know, you have Helter Skelter, and back in the USSR, both – you know, back in the USSR, I think it's John playing bass on it, actually.
Oh, wow.
Playing guitar.
How did you find that out?
You know, the Beatles are one of the best documented bands in the world. There are so many books. There's so many dedicated websites. A great one is BeatlesBible.com. And there's so much wealth of knowledge on that about the Beatles. You find out so much. So much has been written. But the funny thing is, you'll still come across heated arguments over who did what, over who sang what word.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you go back to these interviews and John says one thing and Paul says the direct opposite.
Yeah.
So there's really no way to tell the truth. And I don't really think it matters.
Yeah.
There's four guys that make up the Beatles. You take one out, you don't have the Beatles.
Yeah. Well, also, too, they did so many takes on certain things. They probably wouldn't remember which take was the keeper at that time. I mean, George Martin kept track of that. And there was a book about their sessions, and they did several versions a lot of times of songs as they were evolving, you know, the music was evolving.
I think the title holder is Paul's acoustic masterpiece, I Will, off the White Album.
Mm-hmm.
It's take 67.
Yeah.
67 takes at a 2-minute and 8-second acoustic number. But that was Paul, who was, you know, if you see him live now, he's still pretty darn accurate. He's just going for the right performance. And that's one of the things about the Beatles. And you get into a whole thing of what happened in music after that. They just worked harder.
Yeah.
Sure, they had great talents, but there is an amazing amount. There's in their history, as you look on it on a timeline, it's almost stunning how much music got made, how quickly, and how much it progressed musically and as a band over just, you know, less than 10 years. And it's a lot of it's down to they just never stopped working on it. They worked and worked and worked.
You mentioned he did 67 takes. That wouldn't have occurred in today's music world, correct? I mean, no one would allow their artists to take 67
takes. Well, today in home studios, I'm sure people take a lot and do a lot of takes. But yeah, that was not in a normal studio. Not in a normal studio, they would not. The record companies wouldn't allow you that much time.
And Jeff, you're a guy who I'm sure spent some time in studios with tape. Think about what it was like. Is they're rewinding tape on everything? This isn't digital.
Right.
They're having to re-spool tape. You know, there's a lot of labor going on there.
Well,
and it's 67 takes, and yeah, you couldn't do that now.
Example though of that type of thing happening was Fleetwood Mac, and when they were doing Rumors, they kept redoing it, and they actually wore the master, so they had to make a dub of the 24 track master, and then they continued. It was shedding. It was starting to deteriorate because they kept rewinding it and running it, rewinding and running it so much. And I mean, that's an extreme case, but I mean, yeah, it was kind of interesting. I'm just shocked that he did. Well, of course, you know, Blackbird is a classic. I mean, that's his guitar playing on that. And he's a great finger picker. His first solo album after the Beatles, McCartney, he did all the instruments, which really shocked me because I really hadn't thought about that. At that time, there wasn't as much information, but he did all the stuff himself. He literally played all of it himself. And he was very active, from what I've read, with George Martin talking about arrangements and stuff, and like even when he did when they did Help and the other score, he worked with Martin with the Live and Let Die? Yeah, it was Live and Let Die, the Bond film. And you know, it was a real collaboration there. I mean, he was very involved in that whole thing. So
that's something I talk a lot about in this book, is Paul as a sideman. I mean, a lot of people have, you know, kind of taken on the view that he only thought of himself and he was a very selfish musician, but a lot of his best playing and singing occurs on things that the other guys wrote. You know, if you listen to something and listen to the bass line and listen to the background vocals on that, it's an amazing performance. I mean, no matter who wrote the song, no matter what was going on, Paul did his absolute best to perform it at his peak and be as creative as he could.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like you talk about the guitar playing in Blackbird, and I can't think of many other songs that have that type of picking pattern. It's fairly unique. I've been playing that thing for 40 years probably, and I'm still kind of amazed that he kind of came up with that. It's an amazing little piece of music.
Well, a lot of great players, too, like Stephen Stills. They play that. They've covered that song, and I think even Simon and Garfunkel did that one too. Paul Simon, and that's a kind of a, you know, gives them more cred too, because those guys are amazing guitar players, and they just love that song, and it's a great the what he's doing in there is just amazing. When is this book going to be coming out? You
That's a great question. I think the principal writing is going to be done June, July of this year. I've just gotten into a negotiation situation with one of the world's greatest illustrators.
Oh, cool.
And to some degree, he's going to be involved in the book. We just don't know to what degree yet. But to have this guy sign on the project kind of makes it even more exciting than it's been for me. I've been working on this thing. Really, I've been writing off and on for 6 or 7 years. Where this originally came from, this started a long time ago, probably 30 years ago in Los Angeles. I used to play darts with Denny Sywell. And Denny's a guy who played drums in the first lineup of Wings. And I spent a lot of time with Denny, and he would entertain me with these marvelous... He's a great storyteller, and he's kind of a bigger-than-life guy. And he would tell me these stories. And these stories were all about how cool Paul was, how it was all about the music, how everybody loved Linda, and how everybody got it all wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, about McCartney. And it's just like, that always stuck in my mind. And a matter of fact, it was a great thing. One day, Denny actually took me to his residence, and he played me his gold single of My Love. And, you know, gold records, generally, when they came to an artist, you didn't know what song was actually going to be on it. It was just played it on any other.
Yeah, I know somebody else that played the record, and it was a totally different record than that.
Yeah, but Denny, My Love was My Love, because that was Paul McCartney. And, you know, Denny said, I walked into the first audition, and I said, you know, what do you want me to do? And Paul said, just be you. So he said for the next 3 hours, he tried as hard as he possibly could to be Ringo Starr.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the job.
That's funny. Now, let me ask you one last question before we move on. What was the most surprising thing that you discovered about McCartney that kind of like, you know, I didn't know that type of thing from doing the research on the book and you know, learning about all of that? What was the thing that kind of like, wow?
Nothing. To be honest, he's an amazing workmanlike musician. I mean, there's not these big tales of him in the studio doing this or that, because he's very much, he doesn't talk about it a whole lot. He's not a big storyteller about himself. He doesn't do many interviews. There's not much source material that shows you him in the studio. So and that's something that maybe the surprise is that there was no surprise other than the guy is just a musician and it's just what he does. And every day he wakes up, he makes the best music he can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's still that way today. He's still putting on shows to the very best of his ability. He keeps a great band. They do a fine job. They entertain huge rooms full of people, and he's giving them exactly what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, well, it's kind of hard to, you know, find much fault in the guy's ways. But also, at the end of the day, it's not surprising. It's just a musician being a musician. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe there's not much more story to it than that.
Well, that's all you need, really. That's what it's all about, the music. That's true. So anyway, you're going to have to keep us posted when this gets closer. We'll have you back on when the book is closer to release. But now I want to ask you, the last thing I want to talk about tonight is you're one of the few guys. I've been following this Hi-Rez audio thing. We about a year or so, a little over a year ago, maybe 2 years, Neil Young announced Pono, his music service, and his music player. And basically it's a Hi-Rez music player, a personal portable player, like an iPod, but it plays Hi-Rez FLAC and I think WAV files on it. And there's been a lot of interesting discussion about it, and a lot of the you had mentioned on your Facebook page that you were getting one to test out and evaluate and write about. And I thought that was great because I'll get an honest answer, because a lot of the stuff that's been being released and stuff, a lot of people haven't heard it. They've talked about it. The people that did get one, I thought that some of their testing wasn't valid, and I wanted to talk to you about it. First of all, what's your impression of that? And we'll get a little more into HD audio anyway. So,
you know, it's the first portable under $1,000 D decent unit to listen to high-res audio, and I think they've got it largely right. It surely didn't come out perfect, but here's the whole thing for me. It sounds like it's supposed to. It you know, I don't care if it looks like Toblerone candies. I don't, you know, it's going to sit on my desk probably because I'm going to use it as a music player. But the darn thing sounds fantastic. It does what they said it would do. Now, you get into this whole murky area that we're going to get into about high-resolution sound, and it's like anything. There's always a lot of players, and some of them have the best of intentions, and some of them have not-so-good intentions. And there's players of all ilk in there. But I think the Pono, you know, they're not Apple. They do not have $1 billion to develop a product. Mm-hmm. But they went out and raised $6 million, and I think they did a fine job. I think, you know, it does what it's supposed to do largely. I'm sure there have been some software issues, you know, and their site, there were some problems getting off right away with that. But with what they had to work with and what they've done, the sound thrilled me. And that's what it comes down to for me.
Okay, because to kind of give everybody the insight on what the controversy about it is, one of the things that they were mentioning was that they were going to have available a bunch of real high-res titles and a lot of stuff. And one of the things they were trying to do is ramp up their store so that you could buy a lot of these albums and stuff at a real high sample rate. Like, for example, CD is a 16-bit 44K sample rate. These are 96K 24-bit. So there's a big difference. But the problem was they were – and not just Pono. It wasn't Pono. There's some other sites that are selling high-res audio, and they were claiming that we have 500,000 titles available for you now. Well, we know a guy named Dr. Mark Waldrop. He's the owner of AIX Records, who does a bunch of audiophile high-res recordings. And he has a little email that he sends out every day, and he talks about this. And he's one of the guys that's very angry about people trying to rip you off and claim that they're using high-res audio when they're basically up-resing a CD. And one of the things that happened, there was a review about the Pono when it first came out, and they basically compared an MP3 to this high-res audio file. He did the research and discovered that the high-res audio file was basically an up-res CD. So the frequency response, the quality of the file was limited by what the source was. And both the MP3 and the high-res file came from the same source. So the guy said, I really don't hear a difference. It sounds the same to me. Well, yeah, because it's from the same source. So, you know, that was the thing he was claiming about. And then he had talked to some of the record executives, and they had said, we only have maybe 100,000 titles that have been mastered high-res that actually came from whether it's analog tape or direct digital that are actually there. So there's 400,000 titles there that are basically up-res CDs. And I agree with them. That's kind of a snake oil type of mentality there. The stuff that you've listened to, did you actually get 2496K files? You know that they were from original, they were originally mastered that, and could you hear a difference?
It varied. Now, on the Pono site, they tell you what you're getting in terms of whether it's 1644, 9624. When you go to their store, generally it tells you what you're getting.
Okay.
And I like that from them, but I know there's other people that don't. And it's one of those things that's tough, once again, because some of the stuff I got I knew was high-res. I knew what it was. I knew how it was recorded. But then other stuff was stuff I just wanted to hear through the Pono in the best possible way that I think I could hear it for that money.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was it's just like anything. You have to be a discerning shopper. If you're looking for, you know, an audiophile Rolling Stones record, I don't know what to tell you, because the Stones production values didn't really lend themselves to audiophile descriptions. There's a lot of bleed, there's a lot of, you know, shortening of frequencies, there's a ton of compression, but it's perfect rock and roll, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't know, you know, how much the Stones are going to gain by really high def, but other things like the new album by a group called Black Star Riders, which is used to be Thin Lizzy, they just put out a great new album that was recorded on 2-inch audio tape. And I knew I was dumping a CD into my Pono. I knew I was just putting a CD down. I knew it wasn't high def. But still, I had a really hard time imagining that record sounding much better. Mm. Just because they did such a great job in the studio. The performances are there. Nick Raskolinas is one of the best producers in the world. And he goes absolutely crazy about audio details. So he got it really right. And that's where I kind of go sideways with Dr. Waldrep. And I agree with all of everything he says. His science, you can't dispute it. But I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. There's a lot of great music that's going to be sold as high def, which might not come up to a tech standard, but I think it's worthy of being included in that world. Do you have to call it something different? Maybe you should. But we're in the Wild West here. This is just getting started. And I would compare it kind of like the legalization of marijuana and the medical marijuana stuff and the dispensaries in different states. It's all being worked out in real time, and there's a lot of people who are shifty with standards, and there's a lot of people who aren't doing business right.
Yeah.
But it's up to us as consumers to do our homework and kind of not get ripped off and educate ourselves. And I think if you educate yourself and you really get into it, you will find that high-definition audio is one of the most fantastic things in the world if that's what you're seeking.
Right.
Now, if you just want 50,000 songs on an iPad and you're listening to it with earbuds, I'm going to say keep going and carry on. You don't need high res. You don't need it. Maybe you're not that customer. Right. But if you think you like good things, this is really something you should try out.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, just to clarify too, a lot of people like, well, you know, you can't really hear frequency response after 20,000 cycles. And that's basically the limit of a CD, and then it shelves off really fast, the high frequencies after that. Analog tape, if it's recorded really well, can maybe go up to about 35K. But the thing is, you might not hear it directly, but you can feel overtones. That's why a Steinway sounds different than a Baldwin piano. That's why a Martin sounds different than a Taylor, because there's frequencies that are going up to 50K and even higher in certain instances that give you that timbre. That's where the timbre comes from. So, yeah, that's true. And so people say, well, why do I really need that? And a lot of headphones shelf, even, you know, earbuds might shelf below 20,000 cycles. So you might not even hear the difference there. So I think that it does. I was mentioning before the show, I did a comparison of a CD and a SACD of the same music. It was Flim and the BBs, a jazz trio type of thing. And there was a difference in the dynamics. It punched more. The kick drum, you felt it, wasn't as compressed. There was a little bit more of the room in there that you can hear, that which is high frequency, that imaging from you know, a lot of any reverb or natural reverb in a room, reflection. High frequencies give you that stereo perspective. That's how your ear determines where the direction of the sound is. It's by the phase difference between the sound hitting both ears that your brain interpolates that. And so, yeah, it makes it sound more present. So, but I think that you're right. A good mastered, I mean, I've heard, like, you know, Doug Sachs just passed away a couple weeks ago or something. And he had told me once, he was the guy that mastered Star Wars for all of you. And he basically hated CDs, like Neil Young. He just felt like you were listening through a megaphone, because he could hear the difference of it shelving the top end. But that being said, he mastered for CD, because obviously that was his next step after records. And a lot of his stuff just sounded amazing. I mean, the stuff that he did with Sheffield Labs, the direct-to-disc stuff. So, yes, it's how the performance. I've heard stuff that, you know, and for example, like you said, the Stones, or even like Led Zeppelin, which they've remastered all their stuff. There's distortion. There's wow and flutter. There's print through on their masters that you can hear on the CDs and on the high-res stuff. It's just part of the – they pushed the tape and it distorted. It's part of the sound. I don't think that's a distract. I don't think that really is a detracting high end stuff or high res audio, because you're getting as close as you can to hearing that master tape. To me, is what it where it comes down to.
So, and you know what you're supposed to be hearing. When you hear a Stones record, you know how it's supposed to sound. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there's a certain thing that already exists there. That's one of the things I think is interesting about this whole evolution to high definition, is just the fact that there is before and there is after. Things that are being recorded now sound just amazing, and I get it. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not,
right,
you know, thousands and thousands of great albums from the past that sound just simply wonderful, whether you have it on vinyl, whether you have it on CD, or right, whether you have, you know, a high def.
Well, and it's just like with audiophile equipment. I've had debates with people about audio. You know, they'll spend $50,000 on speakers. You know, some speakers are very flat and accurate. Some speakers color the sound, and they sound nice, but they color the sound. Now, coming as an engineer and a producer, I want to hear what they heard in the mixing room, because that's basically what they're going for. Mm-hmm. So I don't want my stereo system to color it. I want my stereo system to be as flat as possible so I can hear what they're hearing. A lot of people don't agree with that, and that's fine. But, I mean, that's, you know, from a musician standpoint, and I think a lot of guitar players, they want to hear, like, you know, when they record, they want to hear what they're hearing in front of their amp. They want to hear, you know, a transparency to the when they're hearing it mixed into the music. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's important.
It's funny. A long time ago, I used to be a guitar tech for Michael Schenker. And we used to have these hilarious conversations where Michael would go, well, Tony, why does my guitar sound different tonight than last night? And it doesn't sound like the record. And it's like, well, Michael, there's this little thing we got to deal with called physics.
Yes.
A different size room tonight. It's made up of different materials. You know, you have all this wonderful equipment in the studio. And, yeah, that mixing room where you finally hear the mix for the first time, that's when a record is made, I think. And that's probably where it should go from there. Does it or doesn't? You know, it's tough. And there's a lot of different angles on that. And the whole compression and volume wars thing that we've been fighting for years and years. But like anything, I think you can find whatever you want in it. And I love good sound. I love being turned on by audio physically.
Yeah.
So I seek that little rarer air. But at the same time, if people don't get it, I don't really have a criticism for it. I don't. Everybody's different. Everybody's got these differences. But, man, it sure is a fun thing to get into if you're into it.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. Real quick, everybody, check rockguitardailyblogspot.com. Tony he writes regularly on there. You can check out all the stuff he talks about, different groups, guitar players. He tells it like it is. He's very blunt about certain things, and he has an opinion, and it's great. And I think it's great. And Tony, we ran out of time. As you can see, these topics are just great to talk about. We'll have to have you back on, but I definitely want to get you back on when that book is closer to completion so we can talk more about that as we get there. And then,
that was great.
Thank you. And then Scott, also too, you forgot to mention your videos, but you did come out with, you did the Yamaha videos from NAMM.
Yeah, I did 4 videos on Yamaha. So this goes through their new acoustics that they released, and they're also releasing the Pacifica line back in the U.S., which is pretty cool for those of you that are fans of the Pacifica.
That's
so you
cool.
Don't have to
check
get them through eBay.
Yeah, and that's
great guitars. Yeah, I love that line.
That's at Selenium. So anyway, both of you guys, hang on. We're out of time. Thank you for listening for the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show, and check us out on Facebook. And we will be back next week. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks, Sweetwater.
Yes, thank you.